What am I doing?
All right. So now, Mark.
Fuck vampires. I hate vampires.
All right, Mark. I have a question for you.
Are we recording right now?
Yes.
I take back the fuck vampires thing. I really love, I love vampires. All of them except Daywalkers. Greetings, savory inferiors, and welcome to Vampire Insider, the unofficial podcast of the Anne Rice Immortal Universe. Each week, co-hosts Christina LaRusso, Joanne Palumbo, and myself, Mark Snedeker, recap and analyze episodes, delve into the Anne Rice library, and have in-depth discussions of other works about the supernatural. This week, we want to have a free-flowing discussion of some of the ideas and themes we have been seeing online, including the villainization of Lestat and are the books necessary to the experience? We are missing our sassy anchor to the team, Joanne Palumbo, this week because Christina got mad at her and muted her. No, she was having sound problems. That's what it was. So she won't be joining us this week. We will miss her dearly, but she'll be back with us next week, probably with a brand new microphone. Hello, Christina LaRusso.
Hello, Mark Snedeker.
Why do you sound so angry?
because it's always a stressful moment when something goes wrong with the sound.
I know, the sound is our bugaboo.
It really is. It really is. All right, so we are this week not... We're not doing Vampire Insider Writer's Room reading fanfic because we have such a lengthy and involved conversation about the actual show. Vampire Insider Writer's Room will return next week, and please keep sending us those fanfics because we are really enjoying doing that segment. All right, that's the business.
Got the business.
That's a business. If anybody listens to True Crime Garage, that's enough of the business.
Okay.
So you sound so depressed. All right. So where should we launch? Mark, it's you and me.
I wrote an outline. How about you stick to that?
All right, let's go. Let's go. Bossy pants.
Well, aren't you the producer?
Well, I am, but now you're bossing me around. So
a little bit. Mm-hmm. All right.
So one of the topics that I wanted to touch on is the way that some of the characterizations have been changed from the book to the TV series and what that's kind of done in terms of fan response.
That's fair. Okay, so I think first thing we want to establish, though, is that there was a change of character even within the Immortal Universe, in the Vampire Chronicles, rather.
That's correct.
That's a very different Lestat we're seeing in book two compared to how he was portrayed in book one. And you are our book expert, so why don't you tell us what the differences are?
Well, okay. So one thing that has to be kept in mind when you're talking about Lestat or talking about the Vampire Chronicles in general is that Interview with the Vampire was initially a standalone novel. In that novel, in the writing of that novel, Anne felt a strong affinity for Louis.
Yeah.
She felt like she was Louis, like she was speaking through Louis in that
and
book.
She made him the central character of the book.
And he was the central character of the book. He was the vampire. Almost, I think, nine years later.
Is that why she decided not to go with the title Interview with Some Vampire?
So, or a vampire. Yeah. So years later, when she releases the vampire Lestat, now she has more of an affinity for Lestat as a character.
Yeah.
And I have a theory for why that might be, and we'll talk about that later. But the Lestat that comes back in the 80s is a very different character than the Lestat that we meet in Interview with the Vampire. So in Interview with the Vampire, Lestat's a bad guy. He's not a nice guy.
And then in Vampire Lestat, he's Sting.
In Vampire Lestat, he comes back literally as a rock star. And it proceeds on from there. And his star just keeps shining brighter and brighter and brighter throughout the Vampire Chronicles till the end when he becomes the Prince of Vampires. But this is a retcon. This is not Anne Rice saying, as far as I know. Okay, yeah. I don't know this for
sure.
There
are no visible seeds in Interview to hint that Lestat is really a very different guy.
Is yeah, you believe what Louis is saying in Interview with a Vampire. At that point, you don't know that he's an unreliable narrator.
He's a vampire. Who am I to question him?
You believe, as you're sitting down and reading that book, if you come to this series you're going to open the book, if you've never read anything else, read it, you have to believe what Louis is saying because, you know, you don't know that he's an unreliable narrator.
Because he wasn't yet.
He wasn't yet.
as far as we know.
Right. So the point is that Lestat undergoes a little bit of a retcon, quite a bit of a retcon.
I was going to say.
All right. So in the book, The Interview with the Vampire, Lestat is bad in the sense that he...
unkind, insensitive.
Mean to his dad. He's got
brash,
his dad with him.
Yeah.
He is
selfish.
He's doing like these intense kills and Louis doesn't like the way he's doing these kills. He feels... So in particular... there's Babette Frenier's brother, who is the head of the household, and Lestat wants to kill him, and Louis is like, please, no, don't do it, and yet he does. Lestat he's the one that initiates Claudia's creation, and it's meant to keep Louis with him. He is withholding of information. He's like, you know, Louis, I know things you can't leave because I know things you don't know. And Louis doesn't know not to believe him. I mean, it's all of these things that kind of make Lestat this creepy character. And at the end, he's got the second part in the later parts of the book. He's got a hand in Claudia's death, although on some level. And then he, at the end, very end, he's kind of this creepy dude who's stuck in a house and... Yeah. He won't go out, and you think that he's
sort of
like
wasting away,
gonna waste away, and he's sired some other vampires, and one of them is bringing him babies to eat, and
it's a lot.
This is the bad guy. That's who Lestat is, and you don't walk away from that book going, ooh, Lestat. Some people did, but if you come to Interview with the Vampire all on its own.
Right.
Lestat doesn't acquit himself favorably. Louis is the one that you're supposed to come away feeling sympathy for. Now, Daniel in the book at the end, you know that he's going off to try and find Lestat.
Yeah.
So at least in Anne Rice's mind, there was something about Lestat that was going to be worth finding out about, or that Daniel seemed to want to find out about. So that's it. So he's bad like that in the book. In the show, he's a much worse bad. He's physically violent towards Louis in a way that he isn't in the first book. They fight, but he's not like this. He's not flying up, and he's not dropping him from thousands
of stratosphere.
No. And he in the book, there's no sense of Lestat like really cheating on Louis. Like there's no sense of a...
Although, if you had to guess,
I would say yes. But you know, I mean, the love relationship between Lestat and Louis in the book is a little bit is much more subtextual than it is in this. So it's not like he's bringing Antoinette home, and he's like,
because that's an important point, because the sexual relationship or the romantic relationship isn't as overt as it is in the show,
right?
So. I mean, it's possible for someone who wasn't paying attention to go, what do you mean cheat on? They're just bros.
Right. And you know, the love talk is, you know, when Louis finally meets Armand is like, well, didn't you love your maker?
Yeah.
And Louis's kind of astonished about the relationship that Armand is describing about his maker, Marius, and how much he loved him. And so Louis's just sort of detached from feelings of love for Lestat. It's like this weird... It's not the relationship that we're seeing.
Look, Anne Rice
series.
Is working through some things.
She is. Okay? She is, definitely. All right. So that's the difference between the two. So now what has happened, I think, is that people who are coming to the series who have no understanding of the book.
And bless them.
And that's great. And that's what
we want.
Yeah. You know, that's what people, certainly, because the thought then is that, they'll get interested and they will go and they will look into the books, maybe.
Don't care if you read the books ever. It's fine with me. But just listen to the podcast.
Oh, boy. So some people have come to the show, not read the books. many people are like, Lestat's cool. You know, like he's charismatic. He is a bad guy, but he's charismatic. And he's not this like squatter who's trying to take advantage of Louis for his house. He's a rich guy. He's coming and he's fallen in love with Louis. Like he has seen Louis and he's fallen in love with Louis.
In a very stalkery sort of way. And,
yeah, but I mean, he courted him. He gave him some, you know, I mean, he did. And they were falling in love. Fans are responding to him and in a positive way, but then there are also fans who are coming to the show, liking the show.
Yes.
But see Lestat as just like this really irredeemable
bad guy.
Bad guy.
First of all, whatever your take is on the characters, love them, hate them, whatever, it's fine.
Fine.
Like, right? Like, I mean, you're going to like what you like, mm-hmm. right? And not like what you don't like. The only time I'll ever do pushback is if somebody is interpreting the show in a way that isn't justified by the material, mm-hmm. right? They're like, oh, I think, you know, honestly, I think Lestat might be a space alien or whatever, right? I would push back on that.
Well, yeah, depends on
I understand.
Yeah. Where they go.
Just calm down. All right. But, you know, we're not here to tell people they have to like Lestat, or we're not here to tell people you have to treat Lestat like an imaginary pariah because he's a bad guy. Mm-hmm. He is a bad guy. But you can still like bad guys, mm-hmm. and you can even feel sympathy for bad guys. That's how you know you've written a complex character, mm-hmm. right? Is if you can empathize with them somewhat, but also be horrified by them. I mean, that's how it is with us. Yes.
Many people are horrified
daily.
Yeah. Fair.
All right. So we're not here to tell people they have to go one way or another, which I think as fandoms grow is a tendency. They want to curate other people's experience a little bit. We're not here to do that.
No, definitely not. But what I do think is important to note is that you get kind of ebbs and flows in the fandom where people are sort of like, how can you like this guy? How can you find him interesting or attractive? He's a terrible guy. And the thing is that a lot of the people who have read the Chronicles know, well, yeah, he starts out bad or unlikable. And I don't want to say bad because it just what else do you say?
Not
I
mean, he's redeemable. Not,
you're right. But as time goes on, things are going to change. Now, the question is, and here's what I wanted to get to with Lestat, have they made him too irredeemable?
No. And I'll tell you there's one simple way that he's going to be saved is because in a TV show, it is almost impossible to divorce your feelings about a character from your feelings for the actor who's playing the character. And Sam Reed is such an astonishingly good actor and super charismatic mm-hmm. that even when he does bad things, people are like, oh, Lestat, you knucklehead, making that conductor's mouth move like a puppet. That was so funny. You scamp.
No, but there are people that don't find him to be a scamp.
That's right, which is fine. Mm-hmm. You can absolutely, that is a valid interpretation because, of course, he is also a monster, mm-hmm. right? And he's a flawed creature on many, many levels. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that the people who stan Lestat are bad people.
No.
I think there's only a couple of kinds of characters that are still very problematic for people to like. And I think, you know, pedophiles and maybe cannibals, right?
No, because a lot of people like Hannibal.
Right. So pedophiles. That's really – because that's very problematic in terms of, you know, trying to excuse something that is that horrible. Even though we're fine excusing horrible murders. I don't know what it is. It's just how humans work. Mm-hmm. People like Darth Vader, but it's okay to like bad guys. Hopefully you're doing it because there's some interesting things about the character or there are some redeemable qualities and you don't just like him because he's a vicious killer, but whatever. I mean, you like what you like.
Yeah, and I don't think that there is shame in liking that, but there's just it can get fraught around Lestat because of the things that the showrunners have decided that make Lestat bad. And those, I guess my whole point here is that the things that make Lestat bad in the show are really pretty different from the things that make him a bad guy in Interview with the Vampire.
Right.
Just that work. So it's tough. And I have a strong understanding because I see it happen a lot where people will be on people online will feel as if they are attacked, and they in some cases are attacked. You know, they are brigaded, or there are people who will quote tweet them and say, look at this person liking this.
What a knucklehead.
This domestic, you know, abuser. And, you know, and it can get very, very heated.
Right.
And of course someone wants to stand up for themselves and say, hang on, you know, I do like him, and I know that he's doing these things that are wrong. And yeah, okay, I still like him, but you, what do you want me to do? Where do you want? Do you want me to just quit the internet?
To that, I would respond, fictional character. This is a work of fiction. You're not actually admiring a real life murderer. As vivid as his portrayal is, Sam Reed is not a murderer.
And
you
you're
not liking a murderer. You're liking a murderous fictional character.
Yeah.
Which is different.
It is different.
And fiction allows us to kind of explore some of the darker corners of our soul, right? That you can think about these taboo or, you know, immoral or illegal or dangerous things in a kind of a safe space. And what the internet is kind of doing is trying to kind of can opener that and make it more like your position in real life. I don't think that that's a valid criticism of people. Mm-hmm. These people aren't running around dropping their lovers from, you know, 1,000 feet up.
Right.
Nor do they want to.
No.
They're not sitting there cheering that Lestat does this. But overall, they feel an attraction, an interest, an affinity for this character, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. I've given you permission.
Oh, God. Well, you've heard it here first.
Yeah.
It's okay, says Mark. Yeah. But I think, there are those who have some legitimate feelings about this. We can't not talk about this.
Oh, no. I mean,
and here's the point I want to make about it. The choice to cast Louis as a man of color, and we said this from the very first as we were talking about the show coming, and this adds complexity to this situation. And so for a scene like what we see in episode 5 to happen can be something that is traumatic to people of color to watch that, because I think I said this in the first episode that we talked about, when the first episode aired, there's a conversation about race that is going to happen around this series, or should happen around this series. And it's a very different experience for people of color because it plays out literally on their person, right, on their right. body. This plays out now for Louis as played by Jacob Anderson in this very real way.
Yeah.
And I can't speak to it because, of course, I'm not a person of color. And I would love to hear from people of color who might have some thoughts about this.
Yeah.
So I hope that people will weigh in once they've listened to the podcast and weigh
Nobody sitting at home is like, you know what, Mark, as a cis white middle-aged man, I really want to hear his thoughts on race.
No,
you know? They don't.
No one does. Yeah. But I can't not say that someone – This is a conversation that must happen and should happen.
Right.
And I see it happening, and I've been in spaces where brown and black people have discussed some of these issues.
Sure.
And so I don't think that you can discount the people who are coming and are feeling a way that you know, and sharing their feelings of how this makes them feel, this experience of seeing something like this. You know, again, we can't go too deep into it because
don't have enough to say about it.
Well, it's not our experience.
Yeah.
I mean, we have no, this is a conversation that would be best for us to listen to. And I would love, and I would welcome to hear people talking about it because it's an important conversation to have. That said, Lestat, yeah, bad guy, but you know, I think that they had to, the showrunners, make him a really bad guy in the context of a relationship because of the way they've set this up.
They want to have a discussion about a toxic relationship.
A toxic relationship.
And you can't have that if they're both sweethearts, right?
Right, exactly. So now I'll tell you.
Plus they're vampires. They're going to be problematic. Even the nicest vampire, who I guess is Louis, right? He's probably the nicest of all the vampires.
I mean, but define nice. And here's the thing. And it's not just Lestat whose character has changed. I was taking part in a space actually earlier today on Twitter, and we were talking about the various characters and how they have changed from book to show. And Louis has changed. Sure. Louis in the book is kind of this one note, very morose, whiny, very sad guy. And a lot of people have, and a couple of people commented, like, throughout the rest of the books, he stays this kind of this whiny dude.
Yeah.
Everybody loves him. They all love him. They're all sort of taken by his great beauty and, I guess, the perceived depth of his sort of...
Well, look, the ladies love a mopey guy because he's so mysterious. They're like, and I just want to comfort him and learn all of his secrets and listen to his poetry.
But Louis is Anne Rice in a state of extreme grief.
Yeah.
She was writing this book as a way to process her young daughter's death.
Yeah.
Right. And Claudia is kind of the little Claudia is the stand-in for Michelle. So for me, and I said this on a space today, I think that Interview with the Vampire is a book about grief. They've made the TV series a book about toxic relationships and an exploration. That's not to say that there's nothing to do with grief in the show. It's there.
Sure.
But the book is much more focused on grief and existential angst and who am I and why am I here?
Should I continue?
And should I continue? And what is there for me? And it's just grief on grief on grief because, of course, Claudia comes and then goes.
Yeah.
And so it's...
Spoiler.
Spoiler alert. But for me, I see that as a book about grief in the same way that Joan Didion wrote The Year of Magical Thinking, which was her exploration of grief.
Yes.
And then Anne processed that, took a decade in between roughly, and then suddenly was like, you know what? Now I'm following the
Guess
Lestat
what? Now
path.
I'm Lestat.
Now I'm Lestat. Now I'm in this stronger place, and off she goes, right? And so Louis... That, again, kind of gets left in that place.
Right.
Now, fans wanted to see Louis and Lestat together. And so she had to respond to that, or she felt that she did. And it's, for me, interesting that Louis in the series, though, is a very different Louis.
He's a little tougher, I would say.
Yeah.
Right? From the beginning. Not that he still doesn't have his navel gazing moments or his angsty moments. Mm-hmm. He certainly does, but it's not all he does. Right. Mm-hmm. It's not he's more than one note now and he's much more complex. And I think, first of all, I think it was a very, very interesting choice. Did it have to go that way? Well, no, but that's not how we do art, right? We don't only do what is necessary. So I thought it was a very interesting choice. And also their embracing of the true romantic sexual nature of their relationship changed him as well. Because that now gives him, instead of just kind of this, you know, hinted at conflict, now he has to address it head on. Okay, who am I? Well, I'm a person of color in the Jim Crow South, right? Mm-hmm. I'm also gay.
Mm-hmm.
And he has to confront those two elements of his identity while he's trying to learn about this third new element of his identity. I'm a vampire.
I'm a vampire, right.
So he's a much more complex character in the TV show compared to the book. He's maybe less sympathetic at times.
How so? Why do you think
Well, just because now he has a temper, right? Mm-hmm. And he murdered a couple of people because he got mad, right? So he fucked up the red light district pretty badly by sacrificing that guy on his
totally
front gate.
Deserved though.
Yeah, oh yeah,
the alderman.
I'm not saying
he had it coming.
Yeah, I'm not saying he didn't deserve to have his ass kicked. I'm not saying that at all. But the way Louis did it was very reckless.
Right.
And selfish.
Well, it was impulsive, right?
Yeah.
It was impulsive. And I wouldn't say it was selfish. I would say it was impulsive. I would say that he put them at risk. You know, Lestat does these extravagant kills, but he tends not to put them at extreme.
He knows to hide
risk.
Them,
right? Yeah. He and Louis was just like, "I'm going to make a statement, and here it is, and this is the statement."
And then here's another interesting difference between book Louis and TV show Louis is not just the early days of him being a vampire, but now let's talk about his time doing the interviews. Mm-hmm. Right, different guy being interviewed now, by young Daniel mm-hmm. in the book than now Louis being interviewed by old Daniel mm-hmm. in Dubai.
Old Manuel is what they call him.
They really?
Old Manuel. I love that.
Can fandoms just calm down with the nicknames a little bit? Is that possible? It's like Lustad and Manuel and, you know, whatever.
Old Manuel. I love it.
Oh, my God. What's wrong with you people? So very different type of interview.
Totally right? different interview. Totally
and
different story.
The power dynamic has changed significantly. Mm-hmm. Not totally, but mm-hmm. significantly.
Right.
Where in the book, young Daniel is just there with his mouth agape, running his tape recorder, right? Mm-hmm. Not a very active player.
No.
He's not, you know, let's say he's just not. Look, he's not morally safer, okay?
No, he's not morally safer.
Exactly.
On 60 Minutes.
That's right. He's not, you know, he's not asking penetrating. He's not, you know, Edward R. Murrow there. He's just sitting there like, I'm sorry, you're a what?
You're a vampire? Oh,
okay,
wow.
I'm just going to run
one
this
too?
Tape. Yeah, okay, I want to be one. That's not how it works, sir. Mm-hmm. But now he's not afraid to push back mm-hmm. against Louis and or Lewis, as I like to call him. He's not afraid to push back, but he still is not in control, right, of the interview.
Right.
He's still being manipulated, but he's a little bit more aware of it now that
he knows that he's
crusty, old, cynic Daniel.
You know, he knows he's being manipulated, and I think that we were onto something when we said about Daniel that he gets he's doing some trust building exercises there as a reporter. So I think he knows more than, I mean, he doesn't know the facts, but he knows more.
He knows there's some shit.
He knows there's stuff going on. Yeah. He knows that things are not what they necessarily seem, in spite of the fact that Louis said this is all for truth and reconciliation and all the rest.
I think there might be some hijinks.
Yeah, hijinks are afoot. You're correct. I would say that I love the change in Louis' character in the sense that making him a person of man of color, I think it allows for a conversation about black masculinity, in particular in context with the homosexuality. I think that it allows for very interesting all sorts of stuff to chew on, what that really means and what is his struggle, because that informs his struggle in a way that in the book, you know, he didn't have that. He didn't have any of that. No. And none of that was a part of his struggle. His struggle in the book is his...
I have to eat people
with
now.
His his kind of his disbelief of Paul and his religion and is he good or evil and where does he fit into that? I mean, there's his identity as a vampire, which, you know, Louis, your nature, your true nature. Right. In the book, that's code for... as I read it, that's code for being gay, right? Or being bisexual, at least. But so there are so many other things that Louis is having to deal with as this character. It's a much, much, much more interesting character. And I think that what this does then is center the story on Louis in a way that really is deserved in the television series, which in the book, when I was 15 reading it or 14 or 15 reading interview, I liked him because he was deep and he was sad he was, you know, like, and you know, he was black haired and he was just like this handsome guy and so I was like into that mood. That was
a mood for me, you were a very goth kid.
I was so but this Louis is just a rich character and somebody that you can kind of go, okay, I can see him proceeding on in this series and being centered in this series for a long time to come. And one of the things that was brought up on Space Today was, is this the Louis that Anne, if she had her chance to write him again,
would she have done
a Louis like this? And we have no way of knowing.
She could have made him more. She certainly probably would have given him more depth, but you don't know what direction that's going to go.
Yeah,
that's impossible to say.
Right. Okay. Another character who has changed radically is Claudia.
Yeah. They were just dodging a bullet there.
Yeah, because in the book it... So Anne writes a lot of things that flirt around kind of inappropriate age relationships. And that happens in the Chronicles and it happens in...
We call those transgressive.
Yes. Very good. Thank you. Transgressive. and also in the Witching Hour and all the witches books.
Yeah.
Certainly there's some very transgressive relationships described in the... Hello, everyone. I'm going to mention the Sleeping Beauty novels. The Sleeping Beauty novels.
Drink.
but I think that they had to make some of these changes with Claudia to make it be okay.
Yeah. I mean, we're 5 decades later, whatever. So things have changed.
And they've removed the romantic feeling that Louis has from Claudia, full stop, because right. He's gay.
Right.
He doesn't have that feeling for her.
Right.
And it is a very paternal relationship.
Claudia is aged up, yet that also removed the sexual or romantic aspect of their relationship, which you would think it would be the other way around.
Well, it does. No, because it's not her age that removes the... It's not because she's aged up. It's because he's fully gay.
Well, I understand that. But it's interesting that, that those two things happened alongside each other, because obviously it's much more problematic that he's having these tender feelings for someone in the body of
a five-year-old. Yeah.
Which they didn't even go that young in the movie, but in the book, she's five.
She is five. And we weren't going to talk about the movie, but in the movie, they do show like this kind of relationship-ish with Louis and Claudia. I mean, there's a kiss and everything.
I know. Well, problems yikes. Everywhere.
Yikes.
Problems everywhere.
Yikes, yikes, yikes. So, a lot has changed between the characters and one of the things that makes Lestat look very, very bad, but I think also makes Louis look very, very bad, is that in the show at 14, Claudia can pass for an adult.
Yeah.
She could pass with enough makeup and all of that. She could pass. She had this terrible experience when she did try to leave.
Yes.
And so she was kind of forced back by that or made the choice to come back. But then Lestat won't let her leave. He goes after her the second time she tries to leave. And Louis says, go, you don't need me, you think you do, you don't. And then Lestat is horrible to her. And this is another way that Lestat is just being mean, really mean, right?
Which is, of course, Joanne's favorite part of the whole show.
Yeah, she loved that scene. but here also at fault, Lestat does that, but Louis is also at fault. He could have said, you know what, when he walked in and he saw her sitting there, he could have just said, she's going to go.
Yeah.
This is Lestat. This is between you and me. And she's going to go. She can go and go. And he could have chosen that, but
he's weak.
Well, he's very, I think that Louis is a little selfish as a character, and he does put himself and, instead of saying Claudia go, he says, okay, well she stays.
Yeah.
And then that, because of that, the dominoes fall as they do. So Claudia then decides to kill Lestat.
We're going to kill Lestat.
So Louis is kind of also, I think, at fault. And Louis, Louis has his bad things going on as well.
He sure does. All right. So let me ask you this question.
Mm-hmm.
You are a big book nerd, right? You've read all the books multiple times.
Well, and it was some of them.
Multiple times.
I'm in another reread of interview right now.
How necessary do you think the books are to a rewarding experience of the TV show?
Of course, I'm going to say you should read the books. I think the TV show stands alone. I think you can watch the TV show and it will stand alone. And I am going to be very interested to see how they resolve some of the issues that they put. That they put into play with season one.
Yeah.
I asked a question about this on Twitter, and one of the responses I thought was quite thoughtful. And they said, look, if they're going to do something like an episode 5, that needs to be resolved in the same season, because now this long break between seasons, and then we've got the writer's strike. They didn't plan on that.
I don't think they did.
There's going to be a long break before – we kind of come back in next season and we start to see some of these things. Now, that person presupposes that they're going to do anything as a revamp.
I don't think they're going to.
Season of episode five.
I think episode five is what it is.
I agree with you. I think episode five is going to stand as episode five. I don't think that it's going to be that it's an implanted memory or anything like that. I don't think that, but maybe
you never know.
You never do know. So, but I do think that the show stands on its own. I think that your understanding of characters, It might not make you feel better about Lestat ever. You might say, well, I just don't like him. I'm never going to like him.
Right. Which is fine.
Which is absolutely fine. But I think that you will have a better understanding of who some of these characters really are and what the showrunners are working with.
Yeah.
And it's an incredibly rich tapestry. They're not going to be able to put nearly all of the detail that's in the books into this show. But, you know, you get a lot of people thinking that Armand is really like this kind guy or who's there to caretake Louis. The thing about Armand and both Armand and Lestat is that they think that they're working for the greater good, but they're really working for the greater good of Armand and Lestat.
Sure.
So
I can identify with that.
Of course.
Cool.
Of course you can. What do you think?
So I think that it absolutely can stand on its own. That is not always the case. And it doesn't mean if something can't really stand on its own that it's a bad film or TV show or whatever. And I think it's important that you not look at having read the books as giving you some kind of superiority or, you know, special take. You'll have more to say, certainly, right? Because you have now, you know, you have your foot in two universes. But it doesn't make your take on the show any more valid. You know, sneering at people who didn't read the book. Now, I did sneer at people who did not read Game of Thrones, but that's a totally different thing.
All right. No, I think that you're right. And in some ways, it's good it would be interesting not to have read the book. It would be interesting to be experiencing that story without having seen the book or the film. Because think of the surprise that you're going to have when Claudia dies.
I was going to say, don't get too invested in Claudia if you're one of those people.
I envy them in some regards. I also think that, no, they're not to be sneered at. But also, sometimes I feel like saying, hey, you know, give the readers, the ones who've read the books, give us a little bit of the benefit of the doubt when you're talking about these characters. Because, you know, if you've read the book, you do have some insight. Now, we don't have all of the insight because we do not know that they're going to radically change. This could be the Lestat that is Lestat.
Yeah,
this could be it.
Yep.
This could be the Lestat that's the Lestat. Well, you know, we don't know that.
That's the excitement.
One would assume that they're going to show the stuff that happens to him, but we don't know. I mean, yes, we do know. We know that they're going to do the vampire
stuff.
Lestat.
Yeah.
But that's going to be season three. I have a question for you.
Please ask me. You know, I love answering questions.
A lot of what I have been seeing online has to do with speculating about things that happened in season one that maybe make a wrinkle in the story that was unexpected by otherwise people that really are big fans of the series.
Yeah.
But some stuff happened in season one that maybe have them going, ew, that's tough.
Episode 5?
Let's say that episode 5 is one of those things.
That's for you. For sure, right?
Well, it is for a lot of people.
Yeah.
I think that it can go on and stand as it happened. That is what happened. That is series canon now.
Yep.
And how they extricate themselves from that, that's going to be the craft of the writers, right?
Right.
But I think that there are a lot of people who look at episode 5 and say, that can't have happened the way that they say it happened.
Right.
It has to be some sort of different thing. Because I think that they are responding to what we talked about earlier, which is this paints Lestat in a very, very bad light.
It does.
And it's tough. His redemption arc, if he even needs one, it makes it much, it's incrementally more difficult now because of what happened there. And I'm not saying that everyone feels this way. Not everyone feels this way. Some people feel like, oh, well, big deal. Like we can, you know, that they'll be able to figure that out. Or like, I think it was tough, but they've upped the difficulty level.
Yeah.
And I think that the writers will get through it. And there are millions of different ways that people can interpret that. But here is my question. The writers are interacting or have in the past interacted online. They like things that they read. They the writer's room, I think, has a wall where they put the art of some of the fans that they come across, either on Tumblr, I guess, or in Instagram, wherever they Twitter, wherever they see it. And they have that hanging on their wall as some sort of inspiration.
Yeah.
They share that also, I think, with the actors. I think the actors have seen the fan art that they've selected. They are interactive. You know, they do, they're there kind of
trying to participate with the community.
They're in with the
community. Even though, to their unending disgrace,
they haven't followed us. But all right, so let's say, first of all, do you think that writers have an obligation to address things that they see in the fandoms or take that into consideration when they're writing? And do you think that writers do want to, not in an obligation, they see things and they go, ooh, that's a good idea. And maybe they see something and they go a little concerned because they're going to, this could cause a, you know, we know that the Game of Thrones writers did not feel that way.
Well, clearly.
But.
Or maybe they did and they just still fucked up.
Yeah. So anyway, okay. So what do you think in this case?
There's a couple of things you try to balance here. One is your job is writing a TV show that people are going to watch.
Mm-hmm.
That's your number one job. We have high ideals about art and things like that, but ultimately your job is to write a show that enough people find entertaining that they're going to watch so that the show can make money.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, it definitely makes sense to take the fandom as a whole into account when you're writing your episodes.
Mm-hmm.
I would balance that by the artistic argument,
mm-hmm.
which is if you want to guarantee, you want a good shortcut to a shitty script, listen to fans.
Well,
and that doesn't mean that fans are dumb, but they want what they want. Mm-hmm. Right. And you shouldn't. I mean, when I was 7 years old, I wanted to eat candy 24 hours a day. It would not have been good to give me the candy.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So I think that you tend to end up, if you do listen to the fans and you're too responsive to the fans, you end up with some Mary Sue shippy bullshit where you're like, oh, they want these guys to get together. They're getting together and things will feel rushed and awkward and inorganic.
Okay. So
ultimately, no, I don't think they have a strong obligation to the fans, but I think they completely ignore them at their own peril because you want them to watch the show. You do have to recognize, though, that the loudest voices may not represent the largest percentage of your fan base.
Right.
The people who are writing you, I mean, look, we're unusual fans, right? Because we're not normal run-of-the-mill fans because every week we get on and we do a podcast about this show that, you know, a fair number of people listen to. So we're not like the standard normal fans.
No, we have another level of interest in
it. We do.
And we're
invested. So we want them to produce content that we have interesting things to say about. Right. So it's a little bit of a meta game. It's almost like fantasy football where I certainly care about the ultimate story. But what I also care about is that individually each episode has interesting things in there that we can talk about, regardless of how the impact on the ultimate story.
Yeah. See, and I think that is your intention. And for me, I mean, if it was terrible, it would be a hard. Terrible,
it'd be Mayfair Witches, which we managed to podcast,
which
about.
We were able to do. But we, you know, I think it would be. I think then it would be a different thing. I think then we'd be maybe hate watching it and mocking it, right?
Yeah.
Like, but for me, it's a little bit deeper than that. I think because of my longer you're the experience. Big,
yeah, you're with the most invested long-term fan of
fan
the show.
Of the show of and the material. So I would say that I have a much more – that doesn't make me better or smarter or more correct about
No, it's
my analysis.
Yeah.
It's just to say – that I think that it's more than just I want something good to talk about on a podcast. I want I love that the show is good.
Yes.
Because I love to talk with you guys about the show. Okay, so for me, there are certain fan theories that I get where they're coming from. They're very creative fan theories. But I actively think about some of those fan theories. If that's the way the writers go, it's not going to be a very good story.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was talking about, where be careful what you wish for, because what you wish for would make the show shittier.
Yeah.
You think it's something that you want, right, because you love the character and you have a crush on him, whatever it is. Who cares, right? It's legit, however you feel. But if you try to influence the story to go a certain way to favor the character because you think the actor is cute or because you just are fascinated with Lestat or whatever it is, then you're probably going to hurt the story.
Yeah.
Which has to be – I mean, it's based on, you know, a certain written canon, but also they're going to depart from that to do their own thing. And I think that makes the show more interesting. The fact that Rollin Jones's vision is not just trying to copy and paste Anne Rice's books, right? He's trying to do something interesting and artistic, which I appreciate. I think that's made this show excellent, right? And better than, you know, a lot of shows that try to adapt a book, because it makes a very rich and deep show, which gives us a lot to talk about, coincidentally. So I don't think that they have an obligation to the fans to give them what they want. But you also don't want to have disdain for the fans.
No. And now you and I have argued about this on our other podcast, which is Gen X Temporaneous, available on all platforms, everyone.
Check it out. Tell a friend.
But you and I have talked about Ted Lasso.
Yes.
And we disagree about this.
We
have a disagreement about this, but this is something that I feel very strongly has happened. And I think I'm not sure that I agree with the tactic. I think that the writers of Ted Lasso became aware at a certain point in the process of writing the show that people were shipping Ted and Rebecca.
Yeah.
And I think that they never probably intended Ted and Rebecca to be in a relationship more than friends. I think that that is accurate. But I think that they became aware that the shipping was happening. And so
– and they teased the fans.
They teased the fans a little bit with it and sort of said, oh, then that'd be kind of a good head fake and like do a couple of things that make them think that – they're right, that they're right. But then we'll just, in the end, they'll go their separate ways and we will make it so compelling that they, or, you know, maybe they won't be that upset or maybe they don't care as much or maybe they'll will be so compelling that they won't care that they didn't get together. They'll be happy with the ending that we give them. We'll give them something so good for Rebecca that they don't even think that Ted is necessary. That has not that did not happen. So the people who shipped Rebecca and Ted, a large percentage of those people are still, and I mean, I sympathize with them, and I got to a point where I had to mute some people that I was you know, seeing on my timeline a lot because I couldn't stand listening to it anymore. It's like, yeah, I get it. I get it, but they are so angry about it. And I was upset, but not because I shipped them anymore, just because I thought it was a silly ending with Ted going back the way that he did. I think he had to go back, but whatever. Anyway, I'm digressing. But I think that they toyed with the fans.
Yeah.
And I think that that is something that I hope would never happen. I have no reason to believe that it would happen here. I think that the writers just wouldn't do that. And I may be all wrong. Maybe Ted Lasso's writers never did that either.
Yeah.
But it certainly seemed like they did. But yes, they shouldn't treat the fans with disdain. And I think that that's one of the ways that writers could potentially treat the fans with disdain, like sort of get their hopes up and dash them. No one's ever going
to
like that.
Like you go to the courtyard and there's just two piles of dust there. And they keep the camera frozen on those two piles of dust. And eventually one of the piles moves a little bit. They're like, Yes, she's coming back. But she's not coming back.
But she's not coming back. That would be what they would do to Joanne.
Exactly. She's like, yes. No, Joanne.
No, Joanne. You were wrong.
She's
then the wind blows and they blow
dead.
Away.
Yeah, she's super dead.
She's a goner.
I think I told you this the other day. So I was listening to NPR, mm-hmm. as I sometimes do, and they were interviewing, and I didn't catch her name, so I apologize for this. It was a really interesting bit, but I was at work, so I could only listen to so much. But they were interviewing an author whose work is now has engendered this fertile fandom with, you know, fanfic and art and a happy, you know, fun community or who knows, whatever, right? Where people talk about her work all the time.
Yeah.
And her take on it was, as a writer, I can't participate in that at all. They're like, we're told as writers, never read fanfic. Don't go into the community boards because they're afraid basically that they could be influenced by it or even be accused of being influenced by it. And if they write their next story in the thing and some Shades of Grey wannabe says, hey, I wrote that fanfic and it's posted on AO3 and they stole my idea, pay me.
Yeah.
You know, and so they're told don't have anything to do. And she's like, and it upsets me because it seems like it's a really fun community.
Yeah.
And I would love to just kind of wade in there and interact with people. But she said it's just too risky because she's still actively writing her books and she doesn't want to be influenced by them for legal reasons.
Well, now, Anne Rice was very active in her community.
Well, first and, she was well, very active was in suppressing it.
Active in suppressing the fanfic, but
yeah.
But then eventually I think that she came around to that. But we've talked with a number of people who yeah. have said, you know, we wrote her, we emailed her,
yeah.
and she responded.
She's like,
and in some
here's
cases,
what Lestat would say.
That's yeah. exactly what she would do. And so she also interacted with people on Amazon. This is pretty famous too, where they would write reviews of her work, and then she would go in and refute those
yeah,
reviews
like,
and say, you obviously don't know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
while I agree with her, they likely did not know what they were talking about. Everybody's entitled to their own taste and opinions. So
yeah, that seems like a huge mistake.
But she did it. And then the question becomes, I think that there was even something that I was recently speaking with. So this is a space that I was listening to. So this is a little bit apocryphal, but I think you could probably fact check it, where she wanted to get to kind of come to the end with Armand, like not really have Armand in the stories.
Take him out.
And they, you know, not necessarily kill him, but just sort of like phase him out. And the fans said, no, please don't.
Yeah.
And she listened.
Yeah.
You know, he never rose to the level of Lestat's
right.
sort of.
You know, just kind of an aside. Do you know who I always kind of equate Armand with? And it's not super accurate. But remember Eric Northman's sire?
Oh, yes. Yes.
You know what I'm talking
yes,
about? Like
yes.
he was just kind of this quiet, young guy.
Guy. Yeah.
Who has been alive for 10 billion years or whatever.
Yeah.
And eventually he just decides, you know what? I'm going to go check out the sun.
Yeah.
You know? And I'm just going to blow away.
Yeah.
But that, for some reason, I don't know. That's kind of an aside, but that's how I always kind
yeah,
of equate
yeah,
them.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Just
as I know. Well, because he's young.
Quiet, young, ancient guy.
Because he's
yeah.
young. Because, and that, you know, that's always the, that's why young vampires are kind of they're jarring because
yeah.
they're young, but they're old.
Ancient. Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
And, so that's, or can be, you know, they're,
right,
that
sure.
she's Claudia is 5, but she's
right.
also 60.
Yeah.
You
yeah.
know, like how has that happened in your head? Like, God, you'd go it's, crazy. You'd absolutely
yeah,
go mad.
It's very
you'd,
difficult.
You'd absolutely,
yeah.
you'd go mad. Okay. So we both kind of come down on the side of,
I understand taking their feelings into account, but I think in general, that's going to negatively impact the show. Write what makes sense, write what works for the actors, for the producer, for the writers, the director, whatever, and stick to that. Don't go trying to crowdsource your show because you'll just make it suck.
Right. And trying to service everybody,
yeah.
what everybody wants, you
yeah.
will
you'll
disappoint
suck.
Everyone.
Yeah,
you know,
and there'll be no conflict and all the characters are happy. And I mean, Could there be one fan out there who has a brilliant idea for a direction to take the story? Absolutely. There are a lot of very creative, smart people in this fandom.
Absolutely.
But I think the problem is that if you start listening to fans and taking advice from them, you're going to be pulled in a lot of very different and also wrong directions.
I think you're right. I think you're right. I think they have.
We love you. We don't try to write the story.
No,
you can't do
write
it.
Your fan fictions, yeah. Because we love those. But like, yeah, don't worry, you know. And I think and I think that Joanne brought this up on one of the times that we were talking, which is she likes reading the fan fiction, but it also kind of makes her anxious because what if the fan fiction is more satisfying than right. what the writers come yeah. up with? And that, you know, that could, there is a risk of that. There
you
is
think
a
somebody
risk
was writing
that,
fanfic about The Natural back in the day, and they're like, "Yeah, let's change the movie to match this fanfic where he actually hits a home run."
Yeah, yeah. So anyway, yeah. We'll see. We'll see what
and
happens.
I do think it's a mistake for writers to be too involved with the fandom because, especially if you're writing a fantasy or horror. Because you're not operating in the real world, and not everything you do is going to stand up to close scrutiny, right? Yeah. You have to do some misdirection, and you know some things are on the horizon are going to be a little blurry. You don't really have to. It's like, how are you going to explain, you know, how does blood work in a vampire or whatever? Mm-hmm. You can do some lore, but ultimately it's going to be unsatisfactory if it won't stand up to close scrutiny. So I don't like writers trying to explain every little thing that they do. I would just say, read it, you know, just go with that.
Do you think that they can employ, because it is a fantasy world, that they can employ magical explanations?
Oh, for sure.
That then are still satisfying.
Yeah. And that's a lot of fantasy writers. In fact, I think they spend too much of their time doing this, but one of the first things they do when they're going to write is figure out the magical system. Because they want to have something that's unique, but sounds like it could kind of make sense. Yes, it's magic, but mm-hmm. there's some mechanics behind it that we can understand. Mm-hmm. You know, you're drawing energy from the air, or you're learning, you know, an arcane language, or, you know, whatever. You mm-hmm. know, you get your power from, you know, a bracelet your grandmother gave you, whatever mm-hmm. it is. Mm-hmm. But you have to have, you want to have some kind of coherent explanation and consistent explanation for your magic. And Harry Potter did the same thing, right? They decided, okay, there's magical people and non-magical people. And those magical people learn their magic by going to school and doing it. And the non-magical people will always be non-magical.
What about something that is not magical, but is very simple, but also maybe is a little bit of a cheat, which is your unreliable narrator
yeah.
is still unreliable.
Yeah.
And now you're going to hear what really happened, and it right. changes everything, including...
Sure. There are cheap tricks that authors can do to try to get themselves out of trouble.
That would be just disappointing to me yeah. if they just go, well, he's just a completely unreliable
that's
narrator.
That's why if you take a writing course, if you're writing fiction, they're going to dissuade you from employing Deus Ex Machina. Right, which is just a cheat, and believe me, I mean, Shakespeare did it, so everybody falls victim to it sometimes. Mm-hmm. But it's just a cheap way of getting out of a position you wrote yourself into, mm-hmm. and it makes for bad literature or bad art.
The previous season, just a dream.
Yeah, that was the worst. That was one of the worst writing devices.
Bobby didn't die
of all time, but they were listening to their fans.
Yeah. Well, they liked Bobby.
Yeah.
Bobby Ewing, everyone from Dallas. This is
yeah.
an old, old TV show. Well, let's wrap up here. We have one little bit of business that I do want to leave the audience with, and that is we are going to take a couple of weeks off here in October, mainly because I have so much travel with work that I can't record. And second of all, because we need to get Joanne up and running with the right kind of equipment. So we're going to take a couple of weeks off here in October and be back probably by the last week in October. So please go back and listen to some other episodes. In the meantime, I'm going to try and re-promote some earlier episodes so that we don't really skip a week. You'll get something, but it'll be a re-promote from a previous episode.
One thing I want to say is if you have fanfic, that you want us to review, please send it to us. And if you have sent us fanfic that we have not featured on the show, it is entirely possible that that's just due to my own personal lack of organization.
Yeah, and we're going to go comb through emails, make sure that we've captured everybody's requests. So we're getting to you slowly but surely. All right, Mark. Usually Joe takes us out, but I guess I will. Everyone, thanks for coming and listening to us each week. We really appreciate it. Please come and follow us on social media. I guess the best place to do that right now for me is Twitter, and I am also on Blue Sky, at Christina Gen X on both. Mark is at Mark Eats Peach on Twitter. He is at Mark Sned on Blue Sky.
And Threads.
And we have a Twitter account for the show at @vampire_insider. So we hope to see you following us there. We enjoy interacting.
And we have, please visit our OnlyFans.
No.
And our Etsy site.
Stop. No. Okay. All right, everyone. I'm going to say goodnight. Bye.
Peace out, Cub Scouts.